for the glory of old state, for her founder strong and great, for the future that we wait. Raise the song, raise the song.
Where else would you rather be? I'm Paul Clifford, CEO of the Penn State Alumni Association. Welcome to the people of Penn State. Each week on the podcast, you can expect to hear the voices of Penn Staters talking about what they're passionate about, and you can expect to feel the pride and the power of the Penn State network. The People of Penn State podcast can be found on Apple Podcasts or your podcast app of choice. Subscribe and give us ratings. Ratings and reviews are the best way to help other Penn Staters find these fantastic stories. Today on the episode, we talk with Brian Friedman. Brian is a wine, spirits, travel, and food writer. He's a restaurant and beverage consultant, wine and spirits educator, and host, event host and speaker. He regularly contributes to Food and Wine Digital and Forbes.com and 750 Daily. Has contributed to Travel and Leisure Online, Departures Online, Whiskey Advocate Magazine, Wine Enthusiast, The Bourbon Review, and much, much more. He's also hosted wine and spirit pairing segments on CNN Airport Network. And in 2019, Brian was awarded a fellowship to attend the Symposium for Professional Wine Writers in Napa Valley. He consults for restaurants on their beverage programs, regularly hosts virtual and in-person wine and spirit tasting for corporate and private clients, and has traveled to more than 50 countries and territories around the world. I'm so excited to talk about him. As we've talked about on the podcast before, food and I go way back. And so I'm really excited to talk with Brian Friedman. Brian, how are you today?
Paul, I'm great. Food and I go way back too, actually. We have a lot in common already.
Yeah. Let's start at the beginning before we dive into all the deliciousness that is part of our future. How did you become a Penn State Nittany Lion?
So I grew up in the Philadelphia suburbs. And, you know, when it came time to start looking at schools, you know, I think like most people, right? Like most high school kids, I thought I want to go far away. Right. And I applied like to schools around the country, nowhere west of the Mississippi, but still pretty far away. And then I did a long weekend with my parents at Penn State, because they said, look, we know that it's still 3 hours away, but you should just see what Penn State is about. And I think it took like 2.8 nanoseconds, and I'm not a math guy, before, you know, of being there before I said, this is it. If I get in, this is where I'm going. And it was the best decision I ever made. It's really been a formative influence in my life. It's where I met my wife. She went to Penn State. Her family are Penn Staters. My sister and brother-in-law were Penn Staters. We have two daughters. They don't know it yet, but they will be Penn Staters. So it was really sort of love at first sight.
So you got into Penn State. You came up here to Happy Valley. As a student, what were you involved in?
So, you know, I as a student, you know, I mean, I did, you know, casual athletics with everybody, you know, always played tennis and always, you know, played pickup football games. You know, I'm 5'7", 150, so I wasn't necessarily going to be a linebacker on the Nittany Lions, but I always loved playing, you know, with my friends. You know, but then once I discovered writing, and I had discovered writing when I was in high school. And actually, I'll never forget this. My freshman year, I interviewed to be a reporter at the Daily Collegian, and they shot me down. And I found, when I was helping to clean out my parents' house several years ago, I found a rough draft of the sample piece that I had written for them. And despite my deeply bruised ego at the time, this must have been 1995 when I was a freshman, whoever decided not to hire me, it was a brilliant, brilliant move. What I wrote for them was so absurdly pretentious. I mean, just tortured language. So later that summer, I got an internship with the editor, the food section editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, a guy named Jerry Etter. who was really, really an important force in my early career. And I learned actually what this job is. So I reapplied for the Daily Collegian as an arts and culture reporter that following year, my sophomore year. And this time they hired me because what I wrote for them was not just horribly embarrassing and terrible. So I was involved with the Collegian for a good chunk of my Penn State career. There was a local magazine. I don't know if it's still around. I don't think it is, called Buzz Magazine. Do you remember that?
No, it's not. It's not around anymore.
Okay. Yeah. So I wrote for Buzz. I think actually when I was writing for Buzz, like I wrote like about cigars and beer and things like that until they found out I wasn't 21. So that ended on an ignominious note. But the writing, the Collegian was always a very big part of what I did there.
Well, hey, we have to give a shout out to Vincent Longaro. He's our producer on the show, also an alum of the Collegian, was a sports writer and editor for the Daily Collegian. And so I know that's a strong network of yeah. Penn Staters out there. Let's so you talked about discovering that you loved writing and that you discovered that at Penn State. What was your original intent when you came to study at Penn State? Like what was the career goal and what were you majoring in and how did that shift?
So when I first came to Penn State, I don't remember if I was a general liberal arts major. I don't think I was because at the time I still had delusions of going into medicine. You know, my father before he retired was a periodontist. My mother is still an artist by profession. But, you know, I thought maybe I'll go into medicine somehow. And it took like one chemistry class or a math class. I've blocked it out. And I realized I can't do this stuff. That side of my brain looks like a raisin. You know, it, God help me when it came time to do like organic chemistry, I would have spontaneously combusted. So I didn't intend to get an English degree. And then I think it must have been my freshman year, there were a couple of professors who really were formative for me. I had James Brassfield, who had a writing class and then a poetry class. James L.W. West taught a you know, a class on the literature I want to say. I mean, his expertise is on, you know, Fitzgerald, certainly, so that era. And then I had a writing professor who's still there named Toby Thompson. And he's really, you know, he's written a couple of books. He's a very, very respected magazine writer as well. And that's when I thought, okay, maybe this is something that I want to sort of pursue. So I became an English major. I believe it was my sophomore year, I got into the Schreyer Honors College, which was great because then all of a sudden I had that balance of sort of large format classes as well as sort of smaller, more seminar style ones. But it was in the first half of my Penn State career that I realized I wanted to try at least to become a writer.
Whether you're a current student, a recent grad, or you've been in the workforce for a few years or many, Penn State LionLink is for you. We're united by our experiences at Penn State and our desire to connect and help each other. Powered by Alumni Career Services, LionLink offers access to alumni, a chance to mentor or seek mentorship, as well as career resources, all in one convenient place. LionLink helps you connect with other Penn Staters who can answer career questions, provide valuable insights, offer resume and networking advice, and share up-to-date information on industries. If you're interested in joining LionLink, just visit psulionlink.peoplegrove.com.
This is the People of Penn State. I'm Paul Clifford. I'm joined today by Brian Friedman. He's the author of Crushed, How a Changing Climate is Altering the Way We Drink. Brian, before we kind of dive into how you became a food and wine enthusiast and contributor, tell us a little bit about your career path after you left Penn State.
So, Paul, there's no playbook for becoming a writer, right? Like I remember my senior year, I had three other roommates, and those three, they were interviewing, right? They were interviewing with companies. They were looking for jobs, proper employment when they graduated. And, you know, there were questions like, Bri, what are you doing? Shouldn't you be interviewing somewhere, something? And I thought, no, I'm going to do, you know, the Hemingway thing, but not in Paris, but in New York. I said, I'm going to move to New York after I graduate, and I'm going to be a writer. So I moved to New York after I graduated and realized, wait a minute, being a writer is like a job. Like you gotta write, right? You gotta wake up every morning and produce. You have to pitch. There's this whole sense of, you know, building your network of other contributors, editors, other people who are in this strange and wonderful field. And it, you know, after a little while, I realized this is probably, I'm not quite ready yet. Sort of, let's rewind for a sec. My senior year at Penn State, I had a couple of small pieces in Wine Spectator magazine. I always loved wine. I loved its intersection with food. Every night from the time I was around 6 years old, my mother's an amazing cook. My father is a passionate wine collector. And pretty much every night from the time I was six, my dad would come home from work. He'd put his bags down, you know, get changed. And we'd go into the kitchen. My mom would tell us what amazing food she was making for dinner. And then my dad would take me down to the basement and explain why he was pulling like that bottle, not that bottle. And we would sit on the couch and I was given that volume of liquid, right? I don't know. Is that micrometers, nanoliters, small, right? Vanishingly small. And I would sit there on the couch with him and swirl and smell. And I loved it. And I found out early on, I had a really sharp sense of smell and of taste. So I thought, you know, maybe I could write about this, but how do you make a living at that? So I realized early on in New York that I just probably wasn't mature enough to do this, because you got to be self-motivated. And I was going out every night and drinking wine, right? But right. I wasn't actually writing about it. And I got a job at a wine shop, and I got a job waiting tables at a restaurant, and thought, all right, you know, let's sort of pivot here. So I enrolled at NYU in a master's program, and ended up getting a master's degree in secondary English education. And I thought, maybe I could teach high school when I get this degree, and then after school every day I can write. So I came home after I got that degree. So at this point, I'm like, you know, in my mid-20s, I have a bachelor's of English from Penn State. I have a master's in secondary English education from NYU. And I come home and I started teaching high school English. And I taught it for 3 years. And I have such huge, huge, huge respect for teachers. I think it's the work that they do under often very challenging conditions is so admirable. But I realized early on that that wasn't fulfilling me either. And I owed it to the kids who were my students to not be doing that, right? I did the best I could, but it wasn't my passion. And at that point, I had written a novel that I had started when I was in New York, had a literary agent, and, you know, she was shopping it around. So my wife said to me, to her eternal credit, she said to me midway through my third year of teaching, this is 05, she said, Bri, do me a favor. I said, yeah, what? I thought she was going to ask me to pick up like extra pickles or yogurt or something. And she said, you should quit your job and try this writing thing. And I said, well, okay, but you know that the failure rate is like 99.9%. And she said, no, I know that, but, you know, we're in our mid to late 20s. We don't have kids. If you're going to do it, you should do it. And I want you to really try. I don't want you to look back and say, I wish I had, I wish I had. And, you know, I said, okay, just so you know, we're not going to have any money for the first year. And she said, that's fine. I'll figure it out. And she decided she was going to quit her job too, to start a Pilates studio.
Wow.
Yeah. So she was managing other people's studios. And she said, no, I know, we'll figure it away. I said, okay, I lied to you. We're not going to have money for a year. We're probably not going to have money for like 5 to 10 years. I said, let's just give it a shot. So we did. And it was terrifying. it was terrifying. Like, my mom was giving us envelopes of 20 on the sly because, like, we weren't eating enough.
Right.
And, you know, I picked up, you know, assignments from local publications. In the beginning, that first year, I was contributing to a local newspaper, and I was writing 1,000-word stories for 10 cents a word, one a week if I was lucky. So do the math. It was scary times, but that was paying the dues. And you know, I remember in Toby Thompson's classes talking about, he would talk about this process of how you build up a career. And so none of this was really a surprise to me. And, you know, we kept on chugging away, and eventually you find a way to cobble together a living. And as the years sort of go on and go on, you start contributing to more and more places, and you meet people. You know, there were a couple of other writers who have just been so instrumental, you know, for my entire career. John Mariani, who, you know, sort of iconic restaurant writer and drinks writer. He was the restaurant critic for Esquire for probably a decade or two. Right. I met him at a party in 2006, 2007 here in Philadelphia. And after having a couple of drinks to get my liquid courage going, I asked him if I could contribute to his weekly newsletter called The Virtual Gourmet. And then I started doing that. And then Ray Isle, who, you know, is the legendary wine editor at Food and Wine magazine, and, you know, Travel and Leisure. And I got up the courage to ask him if I could start contributing, ironically, at a tasting in far Western Australia. And he, you know, one of the nicest people in the world, said, of course you can, you know, and then did an introduction to an editor. So slowly you build up a roster of publications that you write for, you know, but like all of us, I think, who have unconventional careers, you have to be diversified, right? And that's, you know, it's that's why I do events and tastings in person and virtual for corporate clients. And I'll work with producers and restaurants, helping them develop wine programs and cocktail programs. And it's just, it was not an easy trip. And I'm certainly not at the end of the road. There's 1,000,003 things I want to keep on doing. But it's been very interesting to see that progression. And as I look back on my Penn State education and on the nature of the classes and the professors that I had the opportunity to interact with, I don't know how you prepare someone for this field, but they did. They did. And I'm constantly pulling lessons from those people, from those experiences. It's incredible.
So now that you've built up this roster of publications that you contribute to, what does the day-to-day look like for a contributor to Food and Wine Digital or Forbes.com?
So I guess this is the point of the show, Paul, where I say this is unfortunately not a Zoom background.
That's amazing. I actually was wondering if that was real or if it was just a digital background, but that's amazing. What a collection.
Paul, this is just behind my desk. I have, to the right here, I have an entire rack of tequila. To this side here, we have cognac and Armagnac and other brandies, gins, vodka. Then we have overflow. We bought a house, this old 100-year-old house in suburban Philadelphia. We moved this past June. And this is going back to what a day in the life of my job is like. My wife is an amazing realtor. And so when we were, you know, looking at houses, she said to me, you know, everyone has questions. And she said to me, you know, Bri, if I didn't know you and what you did for a living, I would have been incredibly scared to go on house visits with you based on the questions you were asking. I said, what do you mean? She said, normal people ask, like, how many bedrooms, how many bathrooms, how old's the electrical? She said, you're asking, how dark is the basement? Is there a separate entrance? Are there thick stone walls? And the reason for that is because we get 3 to 4 deliveries a day of wine samples and spirit samples that get sent by producers, by distilleries, by wineries, by their PR and marketing agencies. So, you know, there's a constant flow of product that I need to taste. So when we were looking for a house, I needed a big, cold, dark, unfinished basement. The rest of the house is secondary, maybe a wall to put my booze, but that's about it. You know, because wine needs certain temperatures and it can't have direct sunlight. So my day, you know, it's I'm the luckiest guy in the world to get to do what I do for a living. I'm hyper aware of that every day. And I always say to my wife, you know, if I ever say to you, I'm really tired of what I'm doing, like, just kick me out, just, you know, push me out on an iceberg. There's not many left, but push me out on whatever icebergs we can find. And that's it. We'll get to that. So, you know, it's a job. So I wake up every morning. We have two kids. We have two daughters. Olivia's 8, Sophie's 11. And, you know, once they're off to school, I am here in my office. And for me, my productive writing time is the first half of the day. That's when I write. You know, when I was writing the book, I actually wrote the book while I was training for the Philadelphia Marathon because I have issues. It doesn't make any sense, Paul. But, you know, when I was doing that, I was up at 4:30 in the morning to write my 1,000 words before getting in my miles. But, you know, I think a lot of times the assumption is when you hear that somebody is a writer, right, or that somebody is in any sort of creative field, you're spending a lot of time to wait for the, I'm going to use air quotes, though I'm not an air quotes guy. You're waiting for the muse to come, right? Well, the muse is great, but you can't claim that the muse didn't visit you that week to your mortgage company, right? To the electric company and the water people. So I get up and I know that I am going to, I know what I have to work on that day. And any sort of heavy duty writing, I really try to do between like 8:45 and 10:30 in the morning. The way I write, I know a lot of writers, we all have different processes. Some writers will, you know, they'll knock out 600 words in a day and it takes 8 hours and it's like slowly bleeding yourself, trying, making sure every word is perfect. I'm on the other end of that spectrum where I'll write 1,000 words in an hour. I'm not saying it's good because the editing is brutal. But for me, I get them out, right? I get those thoughts out and then I'll edit in the afternoons. Then I'll taste in the afternoons. For food and wine, once a week, I join the morning stand-up with the other editors and the digital team on Zoom. And, you know, sort of everyone will talk about what they're working on. For them, I've been working on this ongoing series of grape variety guides and wine region guides. And those have been, several a week, actually, for the last few months. So for those, I'll do the writing in the morning. And then, like for today, for example, Paul, I'm filing a piece on Bordeaux. So I'll do all my writing this morning. And then this afternoon, I'll taste. So I'll go down the basement. I'll bring up a couple dozen samples of Bordeaux that I've accumulated. And I'll start tasting. You know, because I know I'm doing a lot of tasting today, it'll be a very bland lunch because you want to make sure your palate is not getting burned out. And that's really what it looks like. And then after that, that's when you start answering emails. You know, you start in the afternoons. That's when I focus on the business of what I do. Yeah. So it's an interesting way to make a living. I wouldn't change it for the world. But I find that I have to be more regimented than I ever expected. The other benefit, and it's the huge unexpected perk of my job, is I get to travel, right? And, you know, we were talking about this before we went on air. Wine and spirits are the most amazing lens through which to see the world, right? I mean, as long as people have been upright, we've been fermenting stuff, right? You know, so it's this lens through which to see history, culture, geology, geography, religion, language, all this stuff. And, you know, in the before times, I was out of the country maybe 1 week out of every month. It's really starting up again. 2.5-3 weeks ago, I spent 5 nights in Spain tasting wine. You know, in another 3 weeks, I'm going to be, you know, for a couple of travel pieces, I'll be checking out some new food and beverage things at you know, at the Four Seasons properties in Bali. I'm taking the kids to, with my wife, to Morocco in December and writing about that. Wow. So it's, I love the fact that this world that I work in and live in gives you such amazing access to just geek out on the most interesting things, right? I mean, I have colleagues who have written books about, you know, the science of distillation and fermentation, right? So for you microbiology people out there, right? That's winemaking and whiskey production. That's microbiology, right? You know, my book Crushed is about climate change. When I first got started, I didn't think that was a thing, right? Like, you know, the whiskey or gin in the bottle or the wine in the glass, how's that to do with climate change? Turns out everything. So it's, you know, for me, sometimes I feel like with my job, you know, when you shine like a laser pointer at the wall when there's a dog around and they right. start like chasing it and they want to just go everywhere where it is. For me, I have to be careful I don't do that, right? Because I still have to meet my deadlines. But I love the fact that if there is an area of inquiry that seems interesting, I have the most amazing editors that I work with. You know, my editors at Food and Wine are just amazing. They're wonderful. They're brilliant. And they're so open to these ideas. And I love that. Just getting to, I'm like a kid in a candy store. I get to explore and write about and taste these amazing products and talk to the people who make them, right? Because nobody gets into the wine or spirits business because they have to. Maybe if you're like the 30th generation of some Tuscan dynasty, sure. right? But nobody says, ugh, I have to think about and write about and make wine today. What a terrible life. You don't hear it.
No, you don't. You referenced your book, Crushed, how changing climate is altering the way we drink. For, you know, my first question really is, how did that come onto your radar, right? You're talking about the samples that you receive, right? And I would imagine a lot of your writing prior to this book was about the product, right? Was about the variety of drinks that you are reviewing. This seems to have gone beyond that into the world of climate change and how that's altering the way that we drink. Where did that motivation come from to write about that?
Oh boy. So it's interesting. So, you know, like I said, one of the big perks is that I get to travel. And when I'm on these trips, you're there with colleagues, you know, with other writers oftentimes, and you're there, you know, you have these meals, you have lunches, you have dinners with winemakers, with distillers, with grape growers. And over the years, climate change and this thing that's happening in the natural world kept on coming up more and more, right? You know, the old question used to be, was it a good vintage or a bad vintage, right? And people would say, like, well, was it a good year in California? I don't know. I mean, that was always an impossible question to answer. Like, California goes from, like, Mexico to Oregon. It's a lot of state, right? So like right. things aren't going to be the same. The weather in suburban Philly is very different today than I'm sure it is in Happy Valley, as it should be. So it was always hard to paint in with a really broad brush, you know, what's happening in one region or country, certainly versus another. But with climate change, the conversation was turning more and more frequently to just how weird everything was getting. Right. And then you hear it on the news. Right. There's fires happening in Napa and Sonoma. There's freak freeze and frost events happening in Europe. You know, there's hail storms. There's, you know, just this summer, it like cleared 100 degrees Fahrenheit in southeastern England. That's not normal. Right. So it was coming up more and more. And I started thinking, what's going on here? Right? Like this is very strange. And I had read a lot of articles and a lot of extended pieces that were written, you know, and a lot of them were written for people in my field, right? But for all the books that are out there about how climate change is affecting our food system, I wasn't really able to find much that was written for consumers, also for beverage professionals, but really for consumers that's narrative driven, that tells the stories of the people who are living and working at the front lines of climate change and how it's impacting them. So, like, over the course of you know, the really scary part of the pandemic, the lockdowns, the quarantines, I think for a lot of us, a good glass of wine, a great cocktail, often at like 3 in the afternoon, like, that got us through the really scary parts, right? Like, it became a joke in our house, right? Oh, it's 3 o'clock, time for a Negroni, time for an old fashioned, right? Save like the martinis for after dark. We're civilized, okay, Paul? But like, you know, it started, things were really getting weird with the climate around the world. And I felt like maybe this is the time that people who ordinarily, consumers who ordinarily would just have a glass of wine, have a cocktail and not give it much thought, maybe now they're thinking, how did this liquid get from where it started to my glass in my house right now? And how's maybe this weird weather affecting it? So over the course of several months, working with my literary agent, you know, we sort of fine-tuned this idea, wrote the proposal. The proposal process, Paul, for nonfiction is really cumbersome. It took months and months. The proposal itself was over 50 pages.
Wow.
And then, you know, we, Roman and Littlefield, amazing publisher, you know, they made an offer and here we are. And then I wrote the book. But the amazing thing was, you know, getting to tell the stories of the producers, of the growers, and how they're dealing with this in their specific parts of the world, right? Because we all hear climate change as this constant drumbeat of terrible, terrifying news. And to a great extent it is. But what I learned is not only do people almost never say, oh shoot, I don't want to be in the wine business, but the people who are in this line of work, who are making the product, who are growing the products, they are often the most passionate, forward-thinking, creative people you'll ever meet, right? So like one of my chapters is on the amazing wine industry of Israel, right? So like, so the question was that I asked, and I visited there last summer to taste and to meet producers. The question I asked is, what do you do in a warming planet for your wine industry when around 50% of the country is already classified as desert or near desert, right? So what do you do? It turns out, for example, that Israel, since its founding, has been a leader in the agricultural technology sector, not just for wine, but for food agriculture as well. Like, you don't have precision drip irrigation as we know it today without Israel, right? I mean, you go there and they have producers who are using drone mapping to look at the health of their vines and hydric uptake on individual rows of vines. So what are they doing? They're chasing altitude. Go higher up into the mountains, which gives you a bigger swing between the warmth of the day and the coolness of the night, which helps maintain acidity. They're leveraging amazing technology, bringing back the sense of a whole ecological system there in their vineyards. And they're really becoming a leader in how the world is learning how to survive and move forward in this world of wine and climate change. And the wines are fabulous. I focus on, for example, you know, Southeastern England, right? Southeastern England has some beautiful white chalky soils, which for anybody who's a fan of Champagne, a lot of the best Chardonnay certainly is grown in, guess what? White chalky soils. So we're talking about similar geology. The thing is, in Southern England, it was always just too cold. It was too wet to grow decent grapes to make good wine. Now, all of a sudden, a couple degrees Celsius higher, they're able to do it. So these are stories of regions around the world that are being impacted in different and unexpected ways and how they're finding their way forward.
Yeah, we've even seen this. So my wife and I and our family moved to State College 6 years ago from the Willamette Valley.
Country.
We were in Eugene, Oregon, and became Oregon Pinot snobs, if you will. Yeah. But it, So the Pinot industry was really big in the Willamette Valley. But now I know that as the climate has changed, they're able to grow the grapes that really thrived in Northern California in the Napa Valley, that it seems to be able to go further north now in terms of producing those kind of grapes. Is that what you've seen in your book?
Yes, absolutely. So it's and there was a great piece. I have to finish reading it, but a highly respected wine writer, he recently wrote a piece, you know, on if about how it's almost like you're denying climate change in a wine region if you're just saying, well, this is what we grow here. This is the one, or these are the two grape varieties we've always grown. We're going to continue to grow them, and that's it. Because that's like keeping your head in the sand, right? And right. This is, I'm drawing a blank on the writer. It'll come to me. I'll link him up when I post this, when I post our conversation here. But it's so important. I think this is a really important point that he's making, is that shifts have to occur, right? You know, in Napa Valley, for example, home to some of the greatest Cabernet Sauvignon on planet Earth.
Right.
You know, when I was growing up, it was a lot of times like that valley floor fruit. Those vineyards were the ones that were the most esteemed, that were the most prestigious. Now, the ones that people that people talk about the most tend to be those mountain vineyards, those hillside vineyards, because they're a little cooler, there's slightly different drainage and geology, and in a world of changing climate, that's a good thing. You know, regions around the world are experimenting with grape varieties that they didn't previously, right? So in a place like Napa, yes, they are learning new places to plant the grape variety that they're so great with, and the wines are just stunning and wonderful. In a place like Oregon, like you said, same thing is happening with Pinot Noir, but other grape varieties too that are maybe that thrive in slightly warmer weather, those are having, you know, a bit of a moment there. In Bordeaux, for example, traditionally there's been five main grape varieties that are permitted, to be made in Bordeaux: Cab Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot, Malbec. But now, in wines labeled, you know, sort of Appellation Bordeaux, there's other grape varieties that are permitted, right? That are more able to be grown in hotter weather. So we're seeing this happening around the world, and there are shifts that are occurring. There's also issues with harvest dates, right? I mean, when I was in Spain the other week, and we're seeing this everywhere, they were saying that, you know, they were bringing in grapes like 3 weeks plus earlier than they had historically over the course of the last 20 or 25 years. Why? Because, you know, earlier bud break in the spring, because, you know, maybe the winter is less short, right, than heat waves during the summer. Sugar accumulation is going up. Acid is going down more quickly. You got to harvest earlier. So these things are changing. And I think the nature of the grape varieties that we're finding from their sort of quintessential homes, that will start to shift over the years.
Brian, when we were off air, we were talking about a lot of things, but we talked about the project that you started during the COVID-19 pandemic, the work from home. Early on, your wife suggested that you start to produce videos and get into the digital space. Tell us about your Instagram show, Day Drinking with Brian.
Day Drinking with Brian. So yeah, this all credit goes to my wife. She'd been telling me for years I should do something like this. And I said, what's the point? Nobody's going to watch it. And then one day, sort of in that spring of 2020, I came down the steps and I said, Steph, I have a brilliant idea. I think I should do wine video tastings. And she kind of rolled her eyes and she said, wow, Bri, that's so smart and creative. How did you ever think of that? And we started, literally, it was just Day Drinking with Brian, because, you know, the kids were out of school for the rest of the year, right? Like Zoom classes hadn't quite started yet, or if they had, nobody knew how to do it, right? And I thought, all right, well, let's do this. So the concept was, I'll talk about one wine and one spirit, in our dining room, which was also our kitchen, which was also right next to where the kids were, like, you know, binge watching Full House in the early part of the pandemic, right? The theme song is like burned into my brain again. And, you know, it started as sort of a lark, just something. Why not? We're day drinking. We're having cocktails at 3 p.m. Once I was done my writing for the day, let's do it on video. And yesterday I posted episode 118. It sort of picked up some traction. I've been lucky enough to work with some amazing brands. I get, you know, great feedback and you know, direct messages from people, you know, every week when we do these. And it's just been a really fun and edifying outlet for me to be able to talk about the products that I love that, you know, maybe I'm not going to be able to write about them for a few weeks or a few months, but right now I want people to know about them. So let's talk about them. Like this right here, I'm all reversed here. Like, this is a whiskey I talked about yesterday. It's the Boondocks 8-year-old port barrel finished Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey, or not straight bourbon whiskey. Like, I loved it. I tasted it. I fell in love with it. I'm writing about it in a few weeks, but, you know, it's getting chilly out, right? Autumn is here. You need a good glass of bourbon. So let's talk about that. So it's been a great opportunity to talk about the products that I love.
Absolutely. So, Brian, I think back to, I'm a fan, I guess, of Gary Vaynerchuk. Yeah. And Gary kind of got his start that way with driving business to his website by talking about the wines that you could buy on his website. So is there, do you get sponsored to feature some of these wines? And kind of how does that work on your end of things? Is there a business plan around what you feature on your day drinking with Brian?
There should be. So let's just say, The wine world now, and that intersection of e-commerce and video, it just doesn't exist the way it does today without what Gary did. I mean, he was a trailblazer, and he remains a trailblazer. Really just brilliant guy, not just in the wine world, but in business and marketing, tech. He's incredible. He has my utmost respect. For me, I should have a business plan. I am approached by brands, by producers, you know, who will reach out and say, "Hey, we have a new release coming out, or we have a couple of whiskeys or gins or wines or whatever it might be, and you know, we'd love to sponsor an episode, and we have, you know, we have the infrastructure in order to do that." But no, I would say a good percentage of the time it is, you know, talking about the things that happen to come across my desk. I think when the companies do come to me wanting to sponsor an episode, I think that's a great way, you know, that sort of cuts through a lot of the white noise, right? Because if I'm tasting, I mean, we have thousands of bottles here, you know, even in the basement. So there's a lot of product that comes through. So it's a great way to sort of get, you know, a little bit more that 8 to 9 minute of focused attention that I can give to it on day drinking. But I think if brands think that there's good synergy with, you know, with what we're doing with day drinking and how we're talking about the products. But no, I should definitely have more of a business plan. My wife has been telling me this for a long time. Don't tell her I said she was right, but she's totally right.
This is the People of Penn State. I'm Paul Clifford. I'm joined by Brian Friedman. He's the author of Crushed, How a Changing Climate is Altering the Way That We Drink. Brian, at the end of each episode, we like to have a little bit of fun. We call it our lightning round. So I'm just going to throw some quick questions at you and get your, you know, kind of your immediate reaction. What was your favorite class at Penn State?
I think my favorite class at Penn State was probably adventure writing with Toby Thompson. That was amazing. And our final project, where we all had to go on some adventure and then write about it, like from a first person immersive journalism perspective. And that was an eye opening and challenging and really edifying experience.
So I realize this next one that I'm going to ask you is like asking you to pick your favorite child, but what is your favorite bottle of wine? Like if you had one last drink, right? What would you choose for that last drink?
Okay. So I'm going to give you such, you're not going to be happy with my answer, Paul. Okay. So look, for me, and I think, you know, for me, I base what I'm drinking with what I'm eating, right? I rarely will open up a bottle of wine just to have three or four glasses of it, right? And just sit there and binge. If I'm binging something on TV, I'm probably going to have some kind of a spirit, some kind of a cocktail. For me, my wine gets consumed at the table. Right. There was, I forget who the winemaker was. It was in France, or I think it was in Italy, actually. And they said to me, Brian, we look at wine at the table the way you in the United States look at salt and pepper on the table. It's an inextricably linked part of the meal. So for me, you know, my favorite wine, my grandfather always used to say my favorite bottle of wine is the one in the glass in front of me. But for me, it's, you know, what am I having for dinner? Last night after my book launch and signing, we brought in from our favorite local Chinese restaurant, right? So what do you have with General Tso's chicken and garlic and eggplant? We had the Moet and Chandon Grand Vintage Rosé 2013 because their General Tso's chicken and rosé champagne are fabulous together. So for me, it's about the food. But if you're pushing me here, my last meal, we all go back to our childhood, right? So for me, it's my mom's Friday night spaghetti and meatballs and probably a rich, dramatic, generous Napa Cabernet from his cellar.
So keeping with that theme, if you could have dinner with anyone, who would it be and why? And what wine would you pair with it?
Oh, wow. Okay. So I would, if we're talking about historical figures, like people... And we all have family members, right, who we'd love to, who we can't have meals with anymore because, you know, we've lost them, right? So, like, my grandfather, Charlie, my grandmother, Gwen, they would, because I would want to break bread with them as an adult at this phase of my life, right? I'd want them to meet the kids. I'd want them to meet my wife. My grandfather did. My grandmother did not. But, you know, if we're talking historical figures... Wow, I mean, you know, I'd love to have dinner with Ernest Hemingway just because I want to see if I could hang with him. I mean, he'd have three drinks before like the salad course.
I was going to say think, Hemingway would drink you under the table.
Although, you know, Paul, don't looks can be deceiving. I 90% of my body is liver, so I'm pretty good here.
Well, and by you, I mean all of us. Like Hemingway, he was probably as well known for his. For his sampling and dabbling than he was for his writing. So
no question. I remember I read The Sun Also Rises my sophomore year at Penn State. And I remember thinking, and like, you know, sophomore year at Penn State, you think like, man, you don't even go out to a party until 10:30 at night, right? Now I'm in like my best sweatpants and a hoodie by 10:30 at night on my couch. And I remember thinking, even at that age, this guy is a beast. I can't hang with him. So I'd love to have dinner with Bob Dylan. I would absolutely love that. And boy, who else would I like to be with? I mean, you know, I'm 45 years old and this is my first book, right? So it was a long time coming. I'd love to have dinner with Mozart, who was like writing symphonies when he was a teenager. I want to pick his brain and see how he did that.
How about your most unusual We Are moment where you heard someone yell out We Are because they identified you as a Penn Stater, or you saw somebody wearing Penn State gear and you shouted it out?
Yeah. So it was 2004 and my wife and I had just gotten married and we couldn't afford a full proper honeymoon. So do you remember the old now defunct US Air? And they used to have those e-saver deals where like you'd get an email on a Wednesday and it would say like, you can fly to Europe for $200, but you got to leave in 2 days. Right. So we decided to do a couple of long weekends in Europe like that for our honeymoon instead of doing like one blowout. So we found this cheap deal. We flew to Paris for a long weekend, right? Which sounds super glamorous, but you should have seen the hotel. Not so glamorous. We had a wonderful time. We're walking down the street. We're walking down the street, not far from the apartment that I had when I studied abroad there. And there was a person must have been like 15, 20 feet ahead of us. And they were wearing a blue and white windbreaker in front of us. And I looked at my wife and I go, I wonder if they're a Penn Stater. And I didn't think I said it too loud. All of a sudden, without breaking stride, without even turning around, the person in front of me just goes, we are Penn State.
That's amazing.
Walking along the street in Paris.
That's amazing. How about your favorite Penn State sport?
I mean, is there anything in the world like going to, you know, going to a Penn State Nittany Lions football game? Absolutely not. Although I will say one of my more memorable moments as a Penn State sports fan, we went, a couple of roommates and I, we camped out early. It was the Penn State Indiana game back when Bobby Knight was the coach.
Right.
And like notoriously, like sort of mean spirited guy,
right.
bad temperature. His temperature was always running high. Always, how's that, Paul?
He was always running hot, right?
Thank you. I need editors when I speak as well. And he, you know, he and you know, his career obviously ended in sort of a not positive manner. But we got like second row seats right behind the Indiana bench. We were like, we're going to just bother Bobby Knight the whole time. And by like midway through the game, Bobby Knight turned around and he made an obscene gesture at my roommates and I. And we're like, this is it. We've peaked. Bobby Knight made an obscene gesture. And I think Penn State might have won that game. So that was it all worked out.
I'm thinking that was definitely in Rec Hall, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So the Rec Hall, that's probably the night that we beat Indiana there. And then a couple of years later, we opened the Bryce Jordan Center. But I remember that game. So certainly you could take some of the credit for the victory that night.
Well, thank you.
And how about your favorite flavor of creamery ice cream?
All right. I got two. Bittersweet mint. Right. I grew up going to the, you know, to the local friendlies with my parents and with my sister, and their mint chocolate chip, their green mint chocolate chip, was always sort of the platonic ideal of what mint chocolate chip should be, right, until I got to Penn State. So bittersweet mint, I think that's don't tell the folks at friendlies, but I like that better. Also, chocolate pretzel crunch. My issue when we really can't keep ice cream in the house.
Right.
Because for me, once I'm done with the ice cream, I need pretzels. I need the salt after the sweet. Right. So by bringing those two together, it saves me from overeating the pretzels afterwards. It's healthy is what I'm saying.
That's amazing. Well, Brian, we'd like to thank you for joining us on this episode of The People of Penn State. Thank you for allowing us to share your story with fellow Penn Staters.
Thank you. It's you know, we were talking before the show. This means so much to me to get to speak with you. You know, my Penn State experience is such a formative one in my personal life, my professional life. And it's a real thrill to be on here and talking with you. So thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks again for joining us. Thank you to our producer, Vincent Longaro, our guest relations coordinator, Mara Ryan. If you like this episode, I hope that you'll subscribe to the People of Penn State podcast on your favorite podcast app of choice. And while you're there, give us a rating and drop us a review. It helps us spread the word to other Penn Staters. If you're a member of the Alumni Association, thank you, thank you, thank you for your support. If you're not, what are you waiting for? Go to our website at alumni.psu.edu, and you too can become a member of the world's largest alumni association. Thank you for listening and for all you do for the university, for the glory, and for the future. We are...
They know!